States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, we hear from senior judge and journalist Margaret Freeman, who joins us to discuss choosing and using whips. And then we'll also be hearing from Stephen Clark as we take an excerpt from the 2015 Trainers Conference Q&A session. All that to come later on in the program. But first of all, the United States was well represented in the CPEDI 3-star presented by Mainstream, Mission Control, Adequan and Neutrina at the Adequan Global Dressage Festival at Palm Beach International Equestrian Center. The U.S. finished atop the team phase of the competition, earned by consistent rides from Roxanne Trunnell, Kate Schumacher, Rebecca Hart and Angela Peavy. Rebecca Hart finished the competition as the highest scoring rider, never receiving below a score of 73.095% for each of her three rides aboard Schurter's Romani. The CPEDI 3-star competition will continue at the Adequan Global Dressage Festival on Friday, January the 22nd, and conclude on January the 24th. For more information on the Adequan Global Dressage Festival and for a full list of all the results as well as a weekly schedule, please visit globaldressagefestival.com. And now, for our first segment this week, we hear from USEF senior dressage judge and veteran equestrian journalist Margaret Freeman, who discusses choosing and using whips. Margaret authored the companion article, Made in America, which was published in the December-January issue of the USDF Connection magazine. Welcome to the program, Margaret.
Thank you.
So we're going to be talking about choosing and using a whip in conjunction with the article in the USDF Connection magazine. What was the premise for this article, Margaret?
Well, originally, I found the Westfield Whip Company in Westfield, Massachusetts, fascinating because it's an American-made product, and they've been making whips there since the 1800s, and at the same location. And Westfield, back in the 1800s, was the largest source of whips in the world, interestingly. And now Westfield Whip is the last remaining company there. The name of the town, the nickname of the town, is actually Whip City. But to have an American-made product like this is really, I think, very interesting. They are undergoing reconstruction. They're going to become a museum. So they scaled back considerably, but are starting to do production again. And their whips, even though there's a lot of hand work involved, are actually fairly economical. I mean, in the $20 to $30 range, and you can get whips that have, you can get the tops engraved, for example, so you can get them personalized or make them commemorative whips. And they make all types. I mean, they make them for driving and polo and lunging and everything. But that was the original thought behind the article, was to talk about this very interesting company. And then, of course, it was appropriate to talk about, in a dressage context, how you would use this product. I find it interesting that I think riders tend to kind of, or riders and trainers, tend to fall into a couple of categories. Either they don't carry the whip as a regular thing, but pick it up when needed. They might have them stationed around the ring. Or they always carry a whip and feel a little bit undressed, uncomfortable without the whip in their hand. You know, that school of thought seems to be, well, if you always are carrying it, you don't have to use it, but it's there when you need it, as opposed to, oh, gee, it's over there on the rail, now I'm going to go get it. The problem with always carrying one when you're showing is that if you go into a class where a whip is not allowed, like a championship class or a CDI, all of a sudden you don't have the whip in your hand, and a lot of horses are very well aware of that. And there are some horses that have to be reschooled at who are used to, say, going international shows, and might have to be reschooled at schooling shows or national shows, just so they don't become automatically inattentive when you're not carrying the whip. I think both approaches are valid. I think it, you know, it, the main use of a whip is to tell the horse to listen to the leg. And depending on how good a rider you are, how well trained you are, too many people, I think, rely on the whip independently of the leg, which is a mistake, but perhaps don't know any better. People don't necessarily know where to use it on the horse. They may have chosen the wrong whip and it is used inadvertently. There's a lot of issues, I think, very often with the whip that trainers don't address. But in terms of two schools of thought, like I said, there are people that either really don't want to carry them unless they're absolutely needed, or there are people that carry them all the time. It seems like a very simple piece of equipment. I feel that dressage whips very often are sort of disposable items. The ends get broken off. They get stepped on. They get broken. So the question is, are you going to spend a lot of money on an exquisite whip, or are you going to perhaps buy lower range whips because you figure that sooner or later it's going to get caught in your car door or the stall door, or the horse is going to eat the end of it, or your cat's going to play with it, and it'll get destroyed. One of the things that really bothers me is when the lash gets worn off the end of a whip and the fiberglass gets exposed and people still use that whip. I think it's dangerous because that fiberglass tends to get sharp and can cut the horse. And, you know, if your whip reaches that stage, you have two choices. You can wrap the end of it perhaps in duct tape, which at least makes it safe in the sense that it won't cut the horse. You won't have a lash anymore, but at least you won't cut your horse. Or you can throw it away. And the whip still seems serviceable. I mean, it's still stiff and seems to work just fine. What I don't think people are aware of is that there is a potential danger that you can cut the whip. And in reality, when that fiberglass gets exposed and you hit the horse with it, it's a much more intense effect on the horse than it is if you just have the lash at the end. And, you know, so I wish more people were aware of that. I just throw out the whip, or at least cover it with duct tape. I don't know if you would like me to talk next about choosing them. Interestingly, you know, the USVS has gone back and forth on what's a legal whip for competition. It was 110. I'm not sure the exact measurement. 47 plus inches for a long time. Then it was reduced to 43 to be consistent with the FEI, and then it went back to 47. I have seen 47-inch whips used on Arabs, and they look like they extend about 2 feet past the back of the horse. A 47-inch whip on an 18-hand warm blood almost looks very short. But if you do want to choose the whip that is appropriate for the size of your horse, if you can, in other words, you don't necessarily want a really long whip with a short horse, with a small horse, unless you're trying to touch specific places on the hind leg. I thought that the lady here on the Westfield whip made a really interesting point to me when we were talking about how to choose a whip. She said that people whose hands tend to be a little bit busy are better off with a very stiff whip because they won't hit the horse inadvertently. whereas people who have very quiet hands might want a more flippy whip, a little more flexible whip, so that a very small action of their hand will activate the whip at the part of the horse they want to touch, whereas a stiff whip, if their hands are very quiet, they might have to use more hand than they particularly want to use, which I thought was an interesting point. She also made a very good point in that if you're going to be selecting a whip, you want to try it with your gloves on and perhaps hold a set of reins, which you can do in a tack shop. Certainly, you pick up the whip, you go to the another part of the tack shop, pull on some gloves, try some reins. You may find that what feels just great in your hand with a bare hand will be too bulky when you add the reins and the gloves. And if it's too bulky, that will tend to make you open your fingers. And then if you open your fingers, the reins will slip. So a whip that feels just perfect with a bare hand may not feel just perfect if you've got a handful of reins. Something else that I have noticed over the years that people have a problem with in choosing a whip is they're not really sure where the balance point is. And it's kind of important to know where the balance point is because that's where you want to hold the whip. If you hold the whip too close to the end, then it's always going to drop down. It's not going to angle across your thigh. If you hold it too far down, you'll get the angle across the thigh, but you've shortened the length of the whip considerably. Usually, the balance point is right where the handle of the whip ends and the shaft starts, so that if you're just holding in your bare hand without gripping it, and you slide the whip back and forth so that it doesn't tip, the handle, which is, you know, how long, maybe 8 or 10 inches, will equal in weight to the whole rest of the whip, like 36 inches of whip. That's the place where you want to hold the whip because then it won't tip down. And so people will very often, when they go to buy a whip, they'll hold it up near the top, but they won't actually get the feel that they want when they're riding. So if you're going to go pick a whip, try it with reins, try it with gloves, hold it at the balance point, the point where it won't tip down in either direction. I think a really cool trick, which I love, I haven't seen a whole lot of other people do it, is to take a rein stop, one of those rubber rein stops that you use on a rein with a martingale, slide it up from the bottom of the whip up to the handle, and let it establish the balance point so that it will be above the place, slightly above the place where the balance point is. Then you just put your hand there, and the whip doesn't slip through your hand at all and drop down. I have found that when I switch my whip from side to side, I have no problem going right back to that point. Other people who borrow my whips haven't always been so thrilled with it as I am, but I love it. But I've also found that when I have that rein stop on my whip, that everybody knows it's my whip, and it doesn't get swiped. And when you're in a boarding stable, there are always whips lying around, and everybody's always borrowing them, which is natural. But when I have my rein stop on my whip, you know, it usually stays put.
That is an old pony club trick. Margaret, yes, we did that back in the day. So I think that's where you must have got it from. It's very handy.
I got it from a lady in Pennsylvania years ago, maybe 30 years ago. And so she might have been a pony clubber. I don't know. But it works great for me. That's interesting. So pony clubbers use it to find the balance point. I know another reason to use it is if you lose your cap.
Yes. We were taught that in Pony Club back in England. So I think the good old tricks die hard.
It's a great trick. And another thing, like I said, you can, that, you know, if you lose the cap end of the whip using the rein stop, will keep the whip serviceable.
That's
if you
right.
lose the other end, like I said, you throw it away or you cover it with duct tape. But
well, some great advice there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some great advice, Margaret. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the program and sharing that with us. There's more information in the USDF Connection magazine by Margaret. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And if you'd like more information, you can read more on this topic and the Westfield Whip Manufacturing Company by following the link to Margaret's article in the show notes accompanying this podcast. And now for our educational segment this week, we have an excerpt from the 2015 Trainers Conference Q&A session with FEI Judge Stephen Clark.
Someone's asked, could I comment on what sort of cross-training, hacking out, gymnastics, etc., would you use for a young dressage horse? For me, I think it's very important that we don't treat dressage horses like hothouse plants, you know. We have to always remember that they are horses, and I think it's very good to give them as much variation as possible or is practical. I've always personally turned my horses out from young horses right through to Grand Prix, a couple of hours every day if it's practically possible. Variations, again, if it's safe, hacking in the woods and that sort of thing is really good to keep horses fresh and treat them like horses. Carl Hester, I know, like with Vallegro, for instance, the horse now knows everything and is on such a high level that between the competitions he does very, very little in the school itself. A good friend of mine, actually, Trish Gardner, who was an Olympic rider herself, she's now, she'd kill me for saying, but 80-something, and she hacks Vallegro out, I think, every day. And before Charlotte broke the world record again in Olympia, she'd actually been out in Australia doing seminars and clinics and things, and just came back and I think rode the horse a little bit in the school and then went to the competition. What I don't like, and I think, I hope it's becoming less, you see the sort of what I call the desperate brigade hammering on and on and on at these poor horses endlessly, imagining that they're going to make things better when actually all they do is make it worse. And the number of riders you see who actually leave their, we call it leave your test in the warm-up, you know, horse can be great for the first 20 minutes out there, but after the hour and a half suddenly they're not so great anymore, and then they come and ride the test and wonder why it doesn't work. Horses need to be fit, strong enough to do the job, properly trained, and not overdone until they're sick of it. You know, that's always my feeling anyway. The shoulder in, technical side of, about 30 degrees, uniformed bend, maintaining the quality of the trot steps, regularity and the length of the stride. And if you keep those qualities and put a horse in a shoulder-in situation, it has no alternative but to engage the inside hind leg more and begin to develop the collection. the shoulder in is the foundation of the lateral work, and it is the most important training tool that we have, really. And in the shoulder in itself, and in various degrees of it, is used as a preparation for almost every exercise, whether it's visible or not. Here's a fun one. At past seminars, the presenting trainers have also been riders and frequently get on students' horses to demonstrate a point. You are not dressed to ride. Do you ever do this? What are the challenges that a non-riding trainer faces, and how do you overcome them? In some years gone by, I often did that too. And during training sessions with riders, you know, on sort of private clinics and things, I would always get on the horse to make a point. And then I realized that actually, as a trainer, your job is to make the rider understand how to make the correction. And I found it was a little bit sometimes the easy way out. It's easy to get on the horse and, make a correction. And sometimes it's valuable to do that, to give the rider the feeling of how it should be. So I do think it's a valuable situation. But also, I think it's very important that as trainers, we're careful to make sure that the rider can do it. Because at the end of the day, when they go down the centre line to do their test, they are all by themselves, you know. So I think it's very important that riders learn to make their own corrections. And also, when I'm teaching personally, I try not, as a general way, to sort of machine gun the riders every single step they take. I think it's very important that you train the riders to be independent, because it's fine for you to stand there riding every single stride from the ground, but in the end the riders have to be independent enough to be able to go in the arena and show the test. So I'm a little bit careful about that. The question again about contact problems and tongues and all those areas. In which of the collective scores are these problems considered? Well, obviously, it's in submission. But also, this is something I always say, the rider, in the end, is responsible for the horse's submission. So it can, to a certain point, influence the rider's score as well. What you have to be careful of as a judge, when you're looking to decide on a score, always remember that you found your score from both the negative points of view and the positive, and there will always be some positive elements as well. If you're not careful, you can think, well, it was tilting its neck here, it was a little bit behind the vertical there, I saw its tongue draw up for a stride or two here, and on and on and on, and actually forget, like for instance, those beautiful, confident flying changes and some of the lateral work that was so well presented and so on. So, you know, it's always a balance between the positive and the negative. Well, here's one for me and Lilo. This is good. How do you come up with the scores and comments so quickly after the young horse tests with multiple judges? Do you communicate during the ride? Oh, yes, we do. Three of us sit together, and it can be a zoo in there, I tell you, if you're not careful. So we plan it before we start that we will have little different jobs, because there's a poor scribe in there as well, listening to all this discussion that's going on. So what I do is organize one judge only is responsible for telling the scribe what to write down on the paper. And I tell the scribe not to listen to all the blah blah that's going on. Only the one judge says, now you write that down on the paper. Another judge, it has the job also of checking that the ride is going in the right way, you know, presenting the correct test. And we discuss while the horse is doing the test, the trot work, we make comments, we decide on a mark as it finishes the trot work, so the mark is down. The same goes for the walk, same goes for the canter, and the other two marks, the submission and basically general impression, were assessing throughout the test, so that as the rider finishes, and remember the public are very interested in these young horse tests, and they do seem to like to hear the comments on the microphone afterwards, so we can't leave them sitting there for half an hour while we deliberate, so we have to be quick. So it's all done and dusted, and as the horse finishes, we should be ready to then speak and keep the competition interesting. Here's a good one about the whip. Since we can't ride with a whip in CDIs and championships, when would you recommend training without the whip? Well, that's a very good point. If you think of a young horse, you start off with lunging a young horse, you have a lunge whip. And the horse learns to go forwards from the reaction of the lunge whip. And then under saddle, the whip is used as an aid, never as a punishment, as an aid to create a forwards reaction. And so it automatically follows through from the lunge whip on the ground to carrying a schooling whip under saddle. And in the national test and so on, you can ride in the test with the whip. And then you need to address the point of being able to train without the whip, because there are too many occasions when a horse or a rider will rely on the assistance of the whip in the test, especially like Piaf, for instance. So it is important that the riders spend periods with training sessions without the whip, so that they know they can make the reaction that they want in the test.
And Stephen will be a presenter at the West Coast Adequan USDF FEI Level Trainers Conference from March the 14th and 15th at the El Sueno Equestrian Center in Somers, California. The deadline for early online registration is March the 4th. However, registration will also be available on site. You can find a complete list of the educational programs here at the USDF by checking on the link in the show notes accompanying this podcast, which will take you to the website. And don't forget, whilst you're there, to check out eTrack, the USDF's online learning center, and the USDF's online store for books and educational items geared specifically to dressage riders. Our membership department would like to remind you that now we are into the 2000 competition year, to be sure to renew your memberships before heading out to a competition. Thank you for joining us this week. Don't forget that you can download this podcast from the iTunes podcast store to any podcast app. We'll be back next week. Until then, remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.